This is bookcareers.com live, the podcast about careers in book publishing for people who are looking for a job, building a career, or who want to do their current job better. I'm your host, Suzanne Collier, the founder of bookcareers.com, and it's my job to solve career problems relating to the book world. Hello and welcome to episode 177 of bookcareers.com live. Our podcast is on a summer break and we're replaying some of our favourite and important interviews, all of which are worth a second listen. Today is a replay of part one of our interview with David Shelley, CEO of Hachette Book Group UK. Please note, this is a replay of an earlier episode and any dates or information may have subsequently changed. Do check our website, bookcareers.com, for the latest news. And today we have a very special guest, David Shelley, the Chief Executive Officer of Hachette. Now, since taking on the CEO role at Hachette in 2016, David has implemented dramatic changes within the company and his influence has reverberated throughout the publishing industry. So, David, thank you for joining us. Let's start at the beginning. Could you run through your career so far, please?
Yeah, sure. Well, firstly, thank you for having me, Suzanne, and thank you for that very nice introduction. It's good to be here. It's something that I care a lot about, helping people get into publishing. So it's great to be here. I mean, my career, I'll try to keep it reasonably brief because I could go on for a long time. But I started off doing unpaid work experience. So that was in 1997 when, that was more of a thing. Unfortunately, it's not now. So I did several lots of unpaid work experience in various publishers and was applying for jobs. Eventually got one at a small company called Allison & Busby. And the job was advertised in the bookseller as editorial assistant come dog's body, which didn't sound that appealing, but I really needed a job. And actually, it turned out to be a really interesting company with a very interesting publisher, Peter Day, who's sadly no longer with us. So I was basically his assistant. That's how I started. It was sort of, even those days, probably slightly old-fashioned in that my role was sort of making tea, and he would dictate letters, and I would type up the letters, and I would do various bits and pieces. And it was a kind of small, eccentric company, but I really liked it. Then, due to a number of things, Peter's health unfortunately became quite bad, and he had to retire. And it was owned by a Spanish company. They appointed someone else. That person didn't work out, and so when I was 23, I was summoned to Spain by the head of the Spanish company, and he said, look, we're either going to close Allison & Busby down, or do you want to have a go at running it? And I sort of thought at the time, I was terrified, because I thought, I'm 23-year-old, what do I know about running anything? I just didn't know anything. It was a small company, as I say, it was five people. But I sort of thought, well, actually, I kind of have to do this, because if I don't do this, I'll wonder, what could have been and what might have been. And it was one of the best decisions I ever made. So it was terrifying. On my first day, our book distributor went bust. So I had to find a new book distributor, which is something I didn't know anything about whatsoever, completely outside my skill set. But just a sort of absolute baptism of fire. Spent 7 years there in total, 5 years running it, and learned everything I would say, sales, marketing such as it was, publicity, fixing a photocopier, taking post to the post, everything. So it was brilliant, and actually sort of the exciting thing was sort of turning the company around a bit, and it focused my mind, I guess, also on making things profitable, because when I started, we kept having to be bailed out by Spain. They had to, put more money into our bank account to pay us, basically, and pay our printers and things. And that felt absolutely awful, because I always had to fax them and ask for money, and that felt awful. So I was very proud, sort of by the end, we were returning money to them rather than them giving money to us. And that felt very meaningful to me, and I guess was a key thing in my development. Yeah, when so after 7 years, when I was 29, someone called Ursula McKenzie, who was a publisher at Little Brown, contacted me and said, look, our crime editor's retiring. She was a very, very established, well thought of crime editor, Hilary Hale, and Hilary's recommended you for this job. And I kind of thought, well, I'm actually loving Alison and Busby now. I got over my fear. I was into the groove. I was loving it. But equally, I could sort of see, well, if I don't work at a large company, I might never know what it's like to publish a huge book that goes into supermarkets, to have like billboards advertising a book on the wall, kind of all that sort of thing. With a small company, as you know, like your resources are quite limited. So I thought, well, if I'm ever going to do this, I probably need to do it now because I'm so happy and so comfortable at Alison and Busby. I probably need to push myself out of my comfort zone. I actually rejected the job to start with and then thought about it again and then thought, no, I have to do this. So I went in and did that. It was weird going from running even a very small company to then being just my only job was buy a few crime novels every year, which felt very easy in comparison. But of course, I'd never worked at that scale before. So actually, it was fascinating kind of trying to make some huge bestsellers, which was exciting and energizing and something really different for me. I was also lucky because I said to Ursula when I joined, can I please do something else? Can I please do something more? And she'd said, oh, well, you can have the audio list and the ebook list. And the ebook list at that time was worth about £100 a year. So there were no ebooks. She'd been very farsighted. She converted all the books to ebook, but there were hardly anyone was buying them. What was great though was, you know, so I joined in 2005. By about 2008, that market had really started to pick up. So I found myself both doing these big crime books and then at the center of this digital revolution, which I think was also a very valuable thing for my career because I learned a lot as Kindle started to explode. I learned a lot about, you know, digital publishing. I then became a publisher. I'm just trying to think about the exact thing. I became publisher of Sphere, which was the, you know, the big commercial imprint. That was a new challenge to me as well, having a team reporting into me, being excited about their books as well as my own books. And it reminded me a bit of Alison and Busby in a way. It's like, that's my own little team. So that was really fun. And then Ursula started to sort of, she told me she was starting to head towards retirement. And she wanted a succession plan. And so she said, well, I'd like you to become my deputy publisher and then, you know, eventually step up to publisher. And so I was working very closely with her, then working across all of the publishing, which was exciting. Then I became publisher of Little Brown. And then Tim Hilly Hutchinson, the boss of Hachette at the time, asked me to be CEO of Orion as well. So I was then doing these two companies, Little Brown and Orion. Orion was a very interesting one because there was a lot of change needed there. And I appointed someone called Katie Espiner, a very brilliant publisher, to become managing director. And she steered a lot of change at Orion. And so I was juggling Little Brown and Orion for a few years. And then when Tim retired, I got his job. The end. That's it.
That is just that. I'd say that is the career path of dreams, that dreams are made of. Actually, that is just absolutely brilliant, and it's quite funny. And just for our audience, I first met you when I was chair of the SYP, and your career has gone in one direction and mine in another. So it's absolutely brilliant to hear of so many successes. And also a mention to Peter Day, who I worked with for a while too.
Much missed.
Now, Eve, there's quite a few pivotal moments in what you've said about your career path. Is there a situation you see as being really pivotal in your self-development? You know, the one decision or circumstance which gave you the skills or knowledge to take your career to the top?
It's a really interesting question, and it's one I've thought about quite a lot. I think what I would pinpoint actually is maybe not just one moment, but sort of times when I failed, I would say, have been very important to me in my career. So obviously, with the way I told it just then, there's an awful lot of, you know, nice things and success and all of that, which is great. But actually, I would say the things that have taught me most are the times when I failed in my career, which is lots of times. And I'll think of, you know, so when I recently started at Little Brown, I published a book I was really excited about, and I paid a lot of money for it, and it flopped very badly. And I kind of feel like I learned so much from an incident like that, because I just thought, I was so gutted about it. I really cared about the book. I really cared about the author. And I was like, I want to really work hard in myself to not do this again. So I kind of looked at all the reasons why it had failed, you know, sort of, I don't know, the cover copy I'd written hadn't been great. I hadn't been strong enough about the cover. I'd not worked closely enough with the sales team. I looked at all the different things. I thought, all right, I don't want to make any of those mistakes again. So I think that, and I think at, you know, if I look back at Alison and Busby, another failure that I had was I was probably sometimes too lax about sort of editorial standards. So we had all the books copy edited and proofread, but I think we could have done a bit more. And I remember getting a letter from a member of the public saying, I love your books, but I wish you'd get them better, you know, proofread better. And for me, that was really important as well, because it sort of showed I need to be more attentive. I have to say, you know, I hope I've got strengths, but one of my weaknesses is a bit of attention to detail and things like that. And I thought, well, I really need to have more attention to detail on things like that. And those standards are very important. So I would say pivotal times for me have been failures and sort of picking myself up, learning from them and moving on, I would say.
That's great. Thank you so much for being so honest about that too. When you became CEO, what did you perceive would be your biggest challenge?
Yeah, I'll put this in broad terms because I need to be reasonably careful, but I would say, and you'll know exactly what I mean by this, I would say a large digital retailer, I thought, I think is a challenge in our business because we have, you know, a large digital retailer that is very large and very successful. And at that time as well, the number of independent bookshops on the high street were going down. And the future of Waterstones, I think, was not as clear as it is now. So I definitely perceived there would be a challenge with online balancing. We'd always, up to that point, had a good ecosystem, I would say, of online retail and high street retail and ebooks and print books. And when I became CEO, I thought that one of the big challenges would be the high street and bookselling.
Interesting. Now, you started the Changing the Story initiative. What prompted that? And is it progressing the way you envisaged?
Yeah, it's a good question, a big question. I mean, two things prompted the start of it. One was I received an email from someone I'd worked with in the business, and who is a woman of colour. And she wrote me a long email, a very heartfelt email, and spelt out for me sort of some of the issues she'd had here and some of the things she'd experienced that I'm sure no one meant her to have a bad time here or to experience bad things, but it was clear that she had. And they were things I'd never experienced as a white man. You know, I'd be lucky. I mean, I'm lucky, privileged, whatever you want to call it. I had never experienced those things. And people have, you know, talked about things like that before. For whatever reason, her email made me, I really took it to heart. And I guess to my point earlier about failure, it sort of made me think like, well, as a business, we've actually failed this person. And we can't, I don't want anyone else to go through that. I don't want to do that again. That was one thing. Another thing was actually having worked at Alison and Busby, I don't know if your listeners will know the history of it, but it was founded by two people, Clive Allison and Margaret Busby in 1967. And Margaret was the first Black British woman to found a publisher in the UK. And I think her guiding influence at Alison Busby, there was an amazing backlist that was very diverse, I would say. A lot of great writers like Roy Heath or C.L.R. James or Buchi Emachita, Chester Himes. It was a very rich, diverse list. And I was conscious at Hachette, actually, that experience always stayed with me. And Margaret wasn't working at the business when I was working there, but she was a close friend to the business and really supportive of me. And I sort of thought, I've always had Margaret in my mind as well. And I've always thought, why haven't we moved on more as an industry since 1967? And that's always, it's been, I think, something a bit shameful for the book industry. So that was in my mind. The email was in my mind. And I thought, so at this time, I wasn't in the job I'm in now. I was doing Little Brown Orion. But I went to my boss, Tim Healy Hutchinson, and said, look, Tim, can I start this thing that is just aimed at getting the business much more representative in the future and is much more about making sure everyone has a good experience here, that everyone is fairly treated, that everyone understands the sort of unconscious things that people do that make people not have a good experience. And he was utterly receptive and said, yeah, absolutely, that would be great, please do that. And then I just sort of called for people who were interested in it to do it. And it was a great group of people from all bits of the company, all levels of the company. And what's always for me being really exciting about our Changing the Story thing is it's grassroots and top down at the same time. So I think there's real engagement from people on the board. So Nick Davis, John Murray was always a massive part of it. Katie Espinel was always very supportive. Charlie King, like Jamie Hodder Williams, a lot of people on the board were very supportive. Hilary Murray Hill, who runs Children's, so there was a number of people who were really supportive. But then equally, there were people who just come into the business who were editorial assistants, who were passionate about it. And we would all sit around a table and discuss, what are we going to do? So we did schools outreach. We did mandatory unconscious bias training for everyone. We did work with Creative Access to get more representative recruitment. There were a huge number of things that happened. We're 5 years on now. Another pivotal thing was we invited people to create networks. So there's different employee networks now in the company that champion different facets of diversity and representation. So we've got a wellbeing network, Pride Network, Thrive, which champions people of color. We've got a number of different networks. They've been really brilliant. We've got about 1,000 people actively engaged. So there's loads of engagement. It's really exciting, yet we know we've got so much further to go. We've done, I think we're on our third year of voluntarily declaring our ethnicity pay gap, and we can see that we just don't have good enough representation at senior levels of the company yet. We have an increasingly diverse cohort at entry level, so when we're recruiting people. But we need to be a lot better at retaining, developing talent and hiring senior talent. And also we have issues, if you look at our gender pay gap, we have issues in kind of gender pay. I think we've got a huge issue in disability. I don't think we're nearly as representative of the population when it comes to disability. So there's still loads further to go. And I'd see it as one of the crucial things for me and anyone of our generation in publishing to try and leave the industry in a better state than we found it.
That is really good. And I think it's brilliant that you've had buy-in from so many senior people, because often with initiatives, it can be the junior people asking for change and not getting that buy-in from the top. So to have that at all levels. And talking about that, why do you think diversity and inclusion is so important to book publishing?
What I always think about in book publishing is we are here to serve readers. That's what we're here for. That's what we're put here to do. And in my view, we need to serve the widest range of readers possible. We publish at Hachette over 6,000 books a year. And I'm very proud of the fact that those books go to all sorts of readers all over the world. When we look at the world, because about 30% of our sales, more than that, are outside the UK. So when we look at not just the UK, but the world is a very diverse place. The world has many different communities in it. The world it is not just kind of white upper middle class Londoners. I think that one of the difficulties and dangers in publishing traditionally has been that it has been made up of white upper middle class, you know, southeastern people, southeast, you know, sort of even sort of, we even did a thing once where everyone put a pin in the map where they lived, and there were so many pins in the kind of East Dulwich Forest Hill area that they were all falling out. So, you know, there are even just within London, there are specific enclaves that everyone lives in. So I really want us to, you know, it's, I think it's important in a moral sense to me that we publish for such a wide range of communities and readers. But to do that, we can't do that if we're not representative ourselves in our building of those readers. We just can't always get it. We, however much we try, we can't get our heads into the place of those readers. So the more diverse we are, I would say, the more books we're going to sell, the more communities we're going to reach, and it's going to be better and better for business. So I think it's really important for commercial reasons, and of course for moral reasons as well.
Okay. Now, talking about diversity, you've opened regional offices. Is this a long-term view?
Yeah, so we had a little correspondence about this, and I hope I was reassuring about that it is very long-term. We have long-term leases. We do have a long-term view. I think we're going to have some teething issues. Stuart, I'll be absolutely open, because we are used to being a very London-centric, as I said, London-centric business. We do already have a few offices around. So we bought a brilliant company called Summersdale. They're based in Chichester. We have some finance teams and some other offices in our distribution centre in Didcot. We have an education business in Banbury. So we have some offices around the country anyway, but they've all been quite self-contained, I would say. This is a completely new thing, because these are people who can work for any of our divisions, who will be working in Newcastle, Sheffield, Edinburgh, Manchester, Bristol. There'll be a mix of teams. It will be this new hybrid, post-COVID hybrid working that is done. And I'm sure, the one thing I've said to everyone is I'm very certain we'll have frustrations. We'll have things like where one of our offices doesn't feel as connected, that there are sort of conversations happening in corridors in London that where colleagues in other bits of the country should be included. But I'm equally certain that we'll feel our way through these things. We'll get through them. I actually mentored someone who worked for Bupa, and I was really interested in talking to him. And that was another thing in my mind when this was happening, where Bupa have offices all over the country. They've been doing hybrid working long before COVID, and they make it work. And so I kind of think, well, if they can make it work, we can make it work. So it is a long-term thing, but my ideal is that we start to radiate out more and more from London. To begin with, we've got about, I think, 60 people joining those offices. We'll have over 100 next year. And the ideal is that we'll always have a London office. I think it's probably inconceivable that London won't always be our main base, but we'll, more and more it will be, people can choose to join us in Manchester or Edinburgh or, you know, Sheffield, wherever. And that as we iron out those difficulties, it will become more and more fluid, and we'll tap into, the exciting thing for me, of course, is that we'll tap into the arts organisations in those areas, the bookshops, the communities of readers, the libraries. We'll get different talent, different viewpoints. And to the point I was making about serving different readers, I think we'll just have different headspace. We'll have more challenge, more sort of creative tension. I think it could be really exciting.
I'm so in admiration of what you've done. I'm going to gush now. I'm so in admiration of what you've done. And you did reassure me. So I did actually question David, saying, look, is this long-term, short-term, you know, and he said, look, we've got long-term leases. This is a huge vision, and I going forward, and I hope our listeners can hear that and what you say. When and how do you think the rest of the industry will follow and expand out of London?
I mean, there are two sides of me here. So one side of me, I'm really passionate about this as a business venture as much as anything. So one side of me thinks like, oh, I hope it's just us, because then we'll have a competitive advantage and we'll be able to hire and work with some great people and have some great authors. Another side of me, I guess the sort of moral side, thinks, well, actually, it would be great if everyone did it. And we just, it helps as an industry. And actually my experience in the industry is usually a rising tide raises all boats. So I know that, you know, HarperCollins have started Harper North in Manchester, which is great. And I know Charlie Redmayne shares a lot of the same thoughts that I do about all of this. So actually, look, I'd welcome and support it if everyone else does. I think they'd be, I think it would be bad business not to think about things like that and to just remain so totally London centric, but each to their own. And as I say, I have these different headspaces when I think about it.
Thank you so much, David. This seems an appropriate moment at which to pause. You can hear the rest of our interview with David Shelley next week in episode 139, where David will be discussing book job transparency, careers and opportunities at Hachette, and the future of publishing, plus so much more. And remember, if you're stuck in your publishing career, or you wish you had a publishing career, then book into the bookcareers.com careers clinic via the bookcareers.com website, or email me at suzanne@bookcareers.com. Now it is your opportunity to join in the live discussion. You can find us across social media using the hashtag bookcareers, or on Twitter at bookcareers, or me personally, Suzanne Collier. Or visit our own platform at bookcareers.com/live. Thank you for listening. May you all be doing a job you love and being paid the salary that you so richly deserve.